On today's show, we got some fine margins as the Irish teams come through the first round of the European Cup with two wins, one loss, and an unbelievable draw. I mean, who wants a win when you can have this a dramatic draw?
Okay. Well, Ulster got a big win at home to French giants Clermont.
It's a draw.
Oh, yeah, we got a World Cup winner.
Joe presents Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby, together with Guinness.
Hello and you're very welcome to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby here on Joe together with Guinness. We're going to jump straight into the start of the show this week and talk Champions Cup. We've got Trimby and Gerry Fannery on the couch with us. Before that, I have something very exciting to announce. Felix Jones, World Cup winner, will be joining us on the couch in about 20 minutes' time.
Excited, lad.
Two-Face Jones will be here. And even before that, I have to announce that Sports Joe has a unique live event called The Great Debate coming up in the Mansion House in Dublin this Thursday night. It will not be broadcast, so your only chance to see it is to get along on the night. We're taking three of the most divisive debates in Irish sport, and they'll be trashed out fight night style by the most opinionated personalities in Irish media. The topics: Dublin GAA has an unfair advantage over all the other teams.
Why you put on a cork accent?
No, because it's probably them that are saying it. That'll be Woolley versus Joe Brawley on that, which would be brilliant. VAR should be scrapped. Dion Fanning versus Ken Early. And my favourite one, the Irish rugby team are celebrity losers. And that's Eddie O'Sullivan versus Ewan McKenna.
I hope it descends to Eddie going.
Well, I presume Eddie will be defending them not being losers.
I would have thought so, yeah.
Yeah.
Eddie will have his hands full there, I would have thought.
Well, you think they're losers?
More just, I think McKenna is going to come locked and loaded.
Yeah.
Although, Eddie, anything I've done with Eddie, he's really well prepped, but I think that he's met his match here. Mm. What do you not think?
I don't know. It's a hard
regardless of where the truth lies.
Regardless
of whether they are losers or not.
Well, if you sit there and if your whole thing is that you're going to pick points that irritate people and you're gonna build a narrative around it and build an argument, or you're generally always going to be pretty well prepped. So
yeah,
the fact that the point is like the Irish team are celebrity losers and you have to defend that, it's like they're not celebrity losers.
Yeah. You're defensive straight away. You're not on the offense.
It's
maybe his battles with Jamie recently have been a good wee warm up for Eddie.
Yeah,
because they've been going at each other a bit, haven't they?
Yeah, but I don't think Ewan McKenna's not going to win if he just starts throwing his eyes at.
Nice one, Eddie.
There's no fear of defamation of character there or something. I presume McKenna's going to come with, like, going after players individually. He's not just going to go broadly.
I think the thing is about the celebrity losers thing is that just that the publicity that the players get when they're coming into a tournament and the media exposure the players get, and he's just saying, oh, they're celebrities, and then because they don't deliver, because they didn't win the World Cup, that they're losers.
Okay.
The fact that it's not going out, Pat, sure, it's not being recorded.
No, it's not being broadcast yet.
So that makes me think
he can say what he wants.
The gloves are off, yeah, he's gonna.
There could be.
Love to go to that.
Yeah.
We better go. I'm going to go to it, man. Just in case.
Anything happened interesting for you over the weekend? We've got a lot to get through today, so keep it, quick.
I was in London for my sister's 40th.
Yeah.
Yeah, we went to Mamma Mia. Yeah. It's brilliant. My mum and dad have loved Mamma Mia. Like, we've been listening to ABBA Gold in the car for car trips, like, to France when we were kids for years.
Right.
My mum and dad went to see Mamma Mia 4 times at the cinema. Wow. And then got out of one of them and booked a holiday to Rhodes.
Oh, my God.
Straight away. They love ABBA, love Mamma Mia.
Wow.
So they brought us along. I got very carried away as well.
You enjoyed it?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's so good about it?
Just the singing and dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you...
Just the showbiz.
Are you a dancer?
No. As the enthusiasm started to spread throughout the crowd, then the person in front of us stood up. Mm. I was there, we're all having a good time, let's not ruin it. I just want to sit here.
Take a seat.
Then everybody started getting up and I had to stand and just like...
Shuffle.
Yeah, just pass myself. Oh. Beside my dad and my other sister, neither of whom are good dancers, so I was able to...
Everyone got up in the seats.
Yeah,
everyone
was like dancing like to Mamma Mia.
That sounds like torture, man.
Mm. It was really, up until, like, literally, that was the last 3-4 minutes. Up until that, it was a
great show. Okay, okay. I thought I'd be like trying to watch the show and having to stand for the whole thing because the dude in front of you is.
No,
like
just at the end, it got a bit, it left a bit of a sour taste for me.
Yeah.
There was enough good stuff to go back, though.
What's it called in London? The West End? I went when I was living in London for a year. I went to quite a few plays just trying to do different shit. We went to the Book of Mormon.
Oh, yeah?
And George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley, the dudes that were in Wham?
Yeah.
They were sitting in the same row as us, and I think Andrew Ridgeley spilled a drink on Katie's lap or something like that. That was as good as it got. Well, it was actually brilliant. That show was brilliant.
They're still pals. They would have hung out until, obviously, George Michael passed away, but...
I'm pretty sure once he's passed away, they've stopped hanging out. Stopped hanging out and be like...
They lost touch. That's cool, though. Yeah. You're sitting next to Wham, like, 20 years after they broke up.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy.
At the Book of Mormon, which is...
That's one I wondered, actually, because up until a while ago, Felix and I were very close, and he stopped texting. I wondered if he died as well.
He's George Michael, yeah. I'm afraid. Yeah. You're the other lad. Yeah. What was his name again?
Yeah, Andrew Ridgeley.
Just been a drink on people.
That's me.
Yeah, going to plays. All right, it was a weekend of fine margins in the European Cup, and we love ourselves some fine margins.
No further questions, Your Honour.
Oh, no. Ulster go top of Pool 3 after an 18-13 win over Claremont, and it all came down to some fine margins. When John Cooney made that little break and chip and try, phenomenal. But if it hadn't happened, they wouldn't have won the game. Leinster defended their line heroically for the last 15 minutes of the first half to keep Leon 10-0 down, leaders of the top 14, correct? Mm. And went, what did they win? 18-13 in the end, was it? And I think down
13-6 was the Ulster
game, sorry. I think those last 10 minutes down to 14 men of the first half, again, some serious defence from Leinster. More fine margins. Connacht, some questionable refereeing decisions and potentially a lot of ill discipline as well. Allowed Toulouse pull away to a 32-17 win over them, which is unfortunate because it could have been a brilliant scalp for them. And Munster, probably the finest margin of them all, when JJ Hanrahan kicked from the touchline to put them 21 apiece, and then the finest of margins, just the little drop goal coming off his the left hand side of his boot slicing just slightly wide.
Mm.
Very disappointing.
It would have been Hollywood if they had gotten that.
That's the sliding door moment. Could have been another huge win for Munster, but you know, a good result all the same.
Yeah, definitely.
Your thoughts on that? It was a classic. I was there. It was a classic edge your seat, nail biting European Cup match in Munster. Crowd were back to their best. Munster played some good rugby, and you know, I think they kept racing scoreless for the last 35 minutes, which I think is probably the most positive thing they could have taken out of that. It looked like Racing were not only going to win, but win with a bonus point about 10 minutes into the second half. So, positively, ultimately.
Racing looked really, really, because like their form has not been consistent this season in the top 14, but they looked phenomenal in the game in terms of how clinical they were when they executed. I thought Finn Russell was like a ninja, and Klassen's Laurie was brilliant. Laurie is Dunnacha Ryan. They're a different side when they. I think we've played them. I think we played them maybe six times over the last few since I was coaching Munster. We probably played them six times, and I think that we beat them. We beat them four of the six, and I think the times that we lost was them just starting to move towards figuring out how to best use their resources. Like fellas like Laurie, who's outstanding on a defensive line out. He's outstanding there. Getting guys like Dunnacha Ryan in, having like Gomez Sa and Benarous starting them from instead of some like Tammy Afuna, they're much, much fitter. They're much more competitive. Their game is based on a lot more than, you know, before it was like just a big play from somebody and then they just hang in there, big play. They seem to have a lot more. And
the breakdown in particular for me, like I don't know if Munster had a turnover in the whole game. They were just killing every breakdown.
Yeah. Yeah, they look like when you've got like I can't underestimate like Dunnacha Ryan is to me is exactly what what the French teams lack when they come to play Irish teams, and Donegal Ryan fills that bucket for them really, really well.
Mm.
Obviously, like guys like Zeebs and Finn Russell are the guys that you're going, and Teddy Thomas are the guys that you're going, we've got to check for these guys. But it's actually, I'm not as concerned about a Finn Russell or a Zeebs or a Vakatawa as I am seeing someone like Donegal Ryan there, because I'm like, oh, this is, you know, this just means that they're going to be competitive for the entire game.
It's the effect he has elsewhere, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, I mean, Finn Russell didn't play that well for Scotland because he didn't have the same platform as you were saying. Rassen were just smashing every breakdown, just making life easy for him.
That nutmeg.
Oh my goodness, that was ridiculous, wasn't it?
Who does that? Like?
Yeah, I know.
Taking souls.
Yeah. All three tries. Yoink. The nutmeg. Teddy Thomas is.
Thank you, Rory. Your soul tastes good.
Like, you can just imagine your legs just closed like that, trying to stop the ball going between your legs. Like you look more foolish. Teddy Thomas's chip, brilliant play down the right hand side. Finn Russell's break for the third one, I felt very sorry for Jeremy Lochman, who had just gotten injured. Looks like, I haven't heard the, Pat, have you heard any?
No, even for Graham was saying after the game that like it looked bad. And he was in a boot at the end on the pitch as
like
well.
He got mangled in the ruck, got up, could barely stand, but got back into the defensive line. And that's the hole that Russell went through. So you have to feel for Lochman. What would you do? You want him to stay out of the line in that play, wouldn't you?
I think he has to just get in the line, just get there and just be a body there. I understand what you're saying,
because it was such a, like watching it in the stand, you're like, what the hell happened there? Then you go back and watch it and tell you, you're like, oh well, he can barely fucking walk. Like,
man, Jeremy's been quality.
Oh, he's amazing,
absolute quality. Yeah, and to lose Kilcoyne with the calf, and then to have Jeremy step up like he has. I think it's very unfortunate that Jeremy's injured.
He'll just say it was John Ryan again.
Yeah. John Ryan is just like, he's getting closer and closer to the three jersey with Ireland the more he plays with Jeremy Lochman. I was like, geez, man, he's playing really effectively around the field. But
Zeebs led the team out.
Mm.
So why did Dunnigan not lead the team out? Because Zeebs is more popular. Is it as simple as that? Yeah.
I think Zeebs would get more from that than Donegal Ryan would. He would feed off that more.
Donegal looks too dishevelled to lead a team out.
Yeah.
He's the man who puts on his clothes and just pulls them and makes them not sit correctly.
Yeah.
Donegal Ryan is the sort of fella who would drag a wheelie bag through an airport with the wheels on the top.
Mike Haley, potentially the best game for Munster, getting a man of match performance, and some very impressive attack play for Munster throughout.
Yeah, I thought Munster looked really, really good. I think it's a measure of how good Racing are that Racing, you know, Munster could definitely have won the game as well. I think Racing were probably the better team across the 80 minutes, but Munster played with some good ambition, and I thought they looked good. And particularly consider that Munster would be still trying to integrate, you know, the internationals back in, that they should get better from there. I think it's just, you could probably, I think I possibly discounted Racing a little bit because as a French side, I'm like, oh, they're going to be hot, cold. But then when you actually look through it and you go, well, you know, they were missing Machinot and missing Nakarawa, who'll make a huge difference when they come back.
Nakarawa is building a house for his dad or something. He's gone missing.
And then they were like, we're going to suspend you. And then he's like, all right.
Go on then.
Just stay here.
Do your worst.
Yeah.
Well, their lineout was pretty mean anyway, even without him. But for him to come back in, but then like having the likes of like having Finn Russell there as a game breaker, like he's just like remember we spoke before about how Rassi used to prep the team by saying, "Listen, you're going to play this team." It was generally Rassing. You're going to play a team, and you'll get everything right. But then out of nowhere, they'll score a try and you'll be under the post going, what's gone wrong? And say, just don't panic. Just know that they have the players who can do that. Like Teddy Thomas and Finn Russell, that was them at the weekend. I thought they were, and having like Vakatawa as well, who probably didn't stand out as much. But Vakatawa, Imhoff, like it's just, there's quality through that team. But I think that Munster have a couple of levels to go up. I thought they would have been happy with how JJ in attack, I thought, stepped up well, and you know, nailing that kick. Look, he didn't name the drop goal, but like that would be a smash and grab, absolute smash and grab. But I think Munster will be happy to have gotten away with a draw. So it just tees up the next two games with Sarries are going to be season defining. And I think Sarries and Ospreys was a very one-sided game. Sarries bringing back some players, like from what I believe, Saracens are probably not going to put any emphasis on Europe.
Yeah,
which means that could be the deciding factor.
But going off last year, we drew to Exeter and then could afford to lose to Cass, but had to win every other game, right? So you'd probably think Munster have to win both games against Saracens, because if they go in with having to beat Racing over there, the last game of the group stages, be up against it, so they got to go balls out and beat Saracens and hope that Saracens don't pick a full strength team.
Yeah, I think that's the key, is that if Saracens go full whack against Munster, it's going to be very hard. If Saracens, and the Saracens seem to be going, we're going to prioritise the Premiership and make sure we stay up there. If they do that, I think Munster have a great chance.
Okay,
we're in a rush here to get Felix on, so we get on to the Ulster game, or do you want to talk about Munster's draw?
Go on with Ulster. Go on.
Do you want to talk about Munster's
draw? Is there anything more than there's not much more than
the fact it was a draw?
Let's talk about the draw.
Okay, Ulster,
the big draw. I'm filming. Well done, lads. We beat Claremont.
Nothing happened. It was boring game.
Yeah,
Jordy Murphy was class. Kutsia was incredible.
Ridiculous. 6, 7, 8, and 9 were all class.
Yeah.
And that was more or less it. That was enough to do the job.
Mm.
Ulster, I said this last week as well, against Bath, they were good, but they just a couple of passes didn't stick, weren't quite clinical enough. See him again. Even Cooney, he was man of the match, was he? Anyway, he was brilliant.
Kutsia
was, you're right, yeah. Cooney was class again. Mm. But he made a break, could have released Jacob down the left. And that would have put them 10 points clear early on. It might have set a tone. They might have kicked on, maybe. There's one or two just passes didn't stick, or one or two moments where they could have scored and they didn't. And it was way closer than it should have been. Ulster were way better than Claremont, I thought. But I think Ulster slipped up because they've given away a losing bonus point. And then to go to Claremont and expect to be within 7 points is quite a big ask to go there. And Claremont.
I thought Claremont were really poor, man.
They were
trying to.
They're still dangerous, though.
Yeah,
but you're right.
Yeah.
They were poor. Like, what do you call it? Arthur Itura?
Yeah.
Him and Iato, the size of those fellas.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They were throwing their
and
weight
Fritz
around.
And Fritz Lee
as well. Yeah.
Fritz Lee. Like, I remember the first time I saw him, we were playing Claremont probably 5 years ago in Europe, and they had, like, he was a 6-plus line-out, so they had a forward, and he was at half-back, and I went, oh, they're going to maul this. He took the ball and just rips, he took the ball off the top and rips a pass, like, 22 metres into the middle of the field, just for Fofana to fly onto. I was like, oh my God, this guy, he's a Kiwi who I think came in on a joker or something like that, and a medical joker, and he's just taken off. He's been quality from Yato, like his physicality in the collisions is insane.
It didn't help them. They swapped their 9 and 10 after the last game, and they brought in the Australian guy at 10 and then his name came off the bench,
Cammy Lopez
came off the bench and made a difference to them. Laidlaw then started, obviously, but Laidlaw's class, but you probably need a wee bit more. Away from home, you need a bit more of an X factor.
They just needed to, like, the first two phases, like their set piece delivery, and then that first pass to get to the kick. Like, I see Abendanen was trying to, they were trying to turn him, like, it looked like a really shitty night, wasn't it?
Yeah, it looked, yeah.
Yeah, and they should have been trying to turn, they were trying to turn them, but the actual delivery by the time they got to the kick was so poor that Ulster had either shut it down or they had the backfield covered. Whereas, and I thought that Ulster played an awful lot of rugby, and I think Ulster's lineout worked really, really well for them, because, like, on a night when their scrum was under the pump, I thought that their lineout gave them really good return in terms of, like, I think they were 100% on their lineout, and, you know, they got pretty good delivery on it most of the time, and they scored a try off it with Jordy Murphy. I think that was key. So you got to look at Henderson running the lineout well, Herring throwing well. I hope
that Ulster have got enough confidence from the last couple of games to kick on now and then start being a little bit more clinical.
Mm.
So they've gone that far and they've started winning those tight games.
He's built a big squad, a good squad,
yeah.
A good solid squad who kind of know what they're about now.
Yeah, and even that back row, everything came from the back row and 9, I think, really.
Mm.
And there's enough strength. So Nick Timoney's coming off the bench, adding something big. Sean Reedy was class.
Mm.
Nick Timoney comes off the bench. Matty Ray is injured at the minute. Marcus Ray finishes last season unbelievably strongly.
Mm.
And then I think he must have picked up an knock because I hadn't seen him at all. But okay. There's plenty of depth there.
It's enough for that win.
That's, no, but that's well done for your draw.
Leinster 13-6 win over Leon. Speaking of shitty nights, it was a pretty shitty night.
Terrible game. Shocking. The low point of my weekend was watching that in a bar, an Irish bar in London with my dad. And I was so bored. We didn't talk to each other the whole time.
Yeah, I think
I was just on my phone.
That last 10 minutes of the first half when Lemoore got sin-binned. The ball was only in play for 2.5 minutes. Leinster just expertly wasted the clock and just kept them out.
They grounded out. They got a serious result.
Their defence has been the most impressive thing to me. Obviously, everyone knows how Leinster can win by playing very, attacking-minded game and so good at keeping the ball and scoring a variety of different tries. But Stuart Lancaster has built a defence that is so hard to break down.
Baz, when you say that, I thought, is it Carl Fearn?
He's ridiculous.
Carl Fearn,
is perfect for French rugby.
Straight off the door in a nightclub in Liverpool, and carrying ball. There was one stage, man. There was one stage when, like, I think you could ask questions. You could go, if you're looking at the makeup of that Leinster squad now, you're wondering like how hungry some guys are. And then when you see Johnny Sexton come in, and I think there was a tip on play to Carl Fearn, and he came in and
smashed him.
Now, I think he got fucked up by somebody else after it.
Yeah.
But it, like, when you've got your 10, the guy that most guys are like, ooh, I don't really want the contact. When Johnny has been as competitive as that, you're like, Leinster's still in a good place. And I thought, like, it was a gritty, disgusting game to watch. But, like, I thought Fardy got through an awful lot of work. I thought Max Deegan, again, Max Deegan's just coming on. I think they'll be happy that Kelleher now, you know, playing in Europe at that level and delivering.
Was their line out a little bit off at times?
Leon contested well, and there's a couple where, like, it wasn't like, I think there was a couple where maybe a couple of overthrows, and there was one where, like, I think it was in the first half, Leon just contested well. It was probably a poor call.
Yeah.
But, like, Kelleher is only going to keep getting better. If you put him in there, you give him that exposure, then suddenly you're like, because you'd start looking, going like, is he good enough to be in the national squad? And then if he's playing at that level and he's doing all right, you know, like, who's the next? Like, with Rory gone, you probably look at Niall Scanlon as the next guy. And if you're just looking at on set piece, like, Munster's line out struggled against an outstanding Racing defensive line out who took Saracens apart the week before. But, like, if that's what it's at, then Kelleher's in the mix.
The test will be when, I don't know how seriously injured Sean Cronin is, how long it is, but the test will be when Sean Cronin comes back from injury. He is injured, isn't he?
Mm. Yeah.
When he comes back, if he doesn't get his place back, that'll be a big moment for Kelleher.
Either then, I think that Kelleher should be looking at getting in the mix. Like, before it was generally Herring, Scannell, Best, Cronin. Well, Best isn't there anymore now, so... Why would Kelleher not be the next man up?
Yeah. All right, moving on to the Connacht game quickly. Almost had a huge win over in Toulouse. I know that's neither here nor there, but 17-15 up after about 55 minutes.
Mm.
Looking good. Looked like they were frustrating Toulouse, and Toulouse didn't look great, to be fair. Again, discipline, I think, let Connacht down, but interesting the way they picked the side. They left Carty out. Left another
Sprout got a start.
Yeah,
he did.
Accurate. I like it. When you're listening. Yeah.
Which kind of shows to me anyway that Connacht are aware that they're probably not going to win the Champions Cup. So the most important thing for them is to qualify for it by doing well in the Pro 14. So they'll probably load the side next weekend. They did it last year away to Sale, I think, as well, where they could have won. It's kind of same scenario. They could have won yesterday, potentially, if they had a stronger team out. But ultimately, Toulouse too strong.
They probably, like, I think, like, looking at Sprout coming in and getting game time, again, like that, it's the fact that, like, I think Connacht have probably got, like, less resources from a playing point of view than the other provinces. So they can't just keep hammering the same guys all the time. So having the confidence in someone like Sprout to put him in there and say, you know, this is up against, like, Romain Entomac, this is like Bezzy, you know, you're looking at quality halfbacks out there, and let's see what you can do against them. And I thought Connacht did. I agree, I don't think Toulouse were firing on all cylinders, but I thought, like, Tom Farrell is quality.
Yeah, a spiral kick halfway through the second half, rifled it down into the right hand corner. which like Munster in the last 20 minutes of that second half on Saturday, you were like, if Raj was here, he would just ping this spiral bounce into either corner.
You just become like the stereotypical Munster fan. If Raj was here and Donovan and Claw, get O'Connell out there. So like O'Connell is so skinny now.
Like, but the spiral
Claw
kick.
Looks like a goblin. Like Mick Galway's about 60, and like Raj is just on Virgin Media all the time, like talking about like. Bring those guys back when they were playing, and they'd have turned it around, man.
The spiral kick, why is it gone out of the game? It's
too risky.
But like, if you get a 10 and you're like, you want to set yourself, like you said about
Felix when he comes on.
Like you said about Felix St. Andrew Conway, that if you want to get your contract to bump it up the next 20 grand or whatever.
Spiral kicks.
Someone as a 10 needs to learn a spiral kick and just, you'll become
just to be clear, commodity. When Andrew Conway wants his contract bumped up, it's not by 20, it's...
Okay. Right, is that enough? We've done enough for that stuff.
Yeah. Done with Munster's draw.
But again, Cooney, opportunist, like on a really shitty day when, I thought the Ulster game was probably the most enjoyable of them, because I said like there's serious progress coming here to beat a team like Claremont there off the back of an away win against Bath, and you know they're all young players who are going to keep getting better. It's whether they can just manage the expectation while those players are coming in and add a little bit more quality with players coming back and maybe a couple of signings.
Then you go back to back.
Let's take a break. Let's take a break and move on from Ulster. I've had enough.
You're listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness.
All right, welcome back and welcome to the show. The first ever Irishman to win a Rugby World Cup medal, which I'm sure you have on you. You carry it with you everywhere, I presume.
Not today.
Did you bite it when you got awarded it?
Yes.
No.
That is a lie, because you sent me pictures of you on WhatsApp going, as in, look how well my life's going. What's going on with you? I was like, oh, fuck's sake.
Mr. Felix Jones, I suppose over the last few weeks, a lot of people have, I'm sure, been asking, like, how did this come about? And the first answer is, well, the easy answer is Rassi picked up the phone and he called you because you've a little bit of history and experience working together. But the long answer to that is you retired in 2015, and this is a journey that I'm going to try and synopsis into 30 seconds. You retire in 2015 at 29 years of age. You get your first job the following season coaching Munster Rugby, the team you've just retired from playing. So coaching a lot of players you played with, a lot of players that are older with than you, coming in under Anthony Foley and Anthony, like, sadly,
and me.
And you.
He's in under me.
Under you, alongside Jerry. You know, the head coach, Axel, passes away. Which I can't even imagine what that was like for the two of you having to work in those scenarios. Everyone knows the story there. You go on to get to a semi-final in the European Cup that year, and then a final in the Pro 14. The following season, Rassi comes in. Rassi's been in already. Rassi and Jack leave halfway through the season. You have to take over the helm of Munster Rugby, and you get to a semi-final and another semi-final that season. The third year, you get to another semi-final and another semi-final. You've throughout those 3 years, you've had some records, like the most matches in a season that Munster have ever won in their entire profession.
Sounds like an American stat. Most matches that you've ever
ever won in one season, and most tries that Munster have ever scored in a season. And then you decide to step away, and all of a sudden you're sitting at home in Dublin wondering what you're going to do.
Caravan and Wicklow.
Caravan and Wicklow.
A tinfoil hat.
But despite all that, have you ever drawn with Rassing at home? Because that's what happened on the weekend. Don't know if you heard, we were talking about it for ages.
And then you get the phone call from Rassi Erasmus. So you go to the World Cup, you win a World Cup. Now you must be the most valuable Irish coach in the world. So where do you go from here?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I don't know what I'm going to do now. I kind of just walking around Sandy Cove, Glastow, just saying hello to people and giving time to Leanne and the lads. So there's not
giving time to them, is it? Yeah. Like, they're so lucky to get time. You're like, it's your partner and they're your kids. So I'm giving them time as well.
Yeah, no, I actually do mean actually spending more time because it's been so mental. It has been mental over the last couple of years. And then obviously going over to Japan for. We went out early, so we went out 2 weeks early to play Japan in a warm-up game. So and then went back to South Africa then for a couple of days for we went around the country, which was crazy, but literally not really seeing the family a lot over the last couple of months. And then obviously, sure, you know how insane it can be at times when you're in the thick of it with Munster, and especially European weeks, that you don't really get to see much of them. So I've kind of said, look, we'll do Christmas at least. And then
Leanne flew over, didn't she?
Leanne came over for the semi and the final. Yeah. So
did you get any time with her?
Very little. Very little. I think we had one down day during that week, and then but even then you're just so tired from the build up and there's so much going on that you're kind of you're not much crack. Not much crack at the best.
You weren't too tired when you were sending me pictures on the piss for the week after the final. So they obviously didn't work too hard up to there. It's a pretty crazy story. But Felix, what I'm like, you take it back to your first involvement. So when you was your first involvement when you flew over for that game against Japan?
Yeah.
So like, what was that like? Did Rassi introduce you to them? Like you literally were sitting in your caravan in Wicklow with your tinfoil hat on, and then 3 or 4 days later, you're over in Japan being introduced to the box.
I don't think it was 3 or 4. It's probably a little bit longer because I knew I had time to get ready on Japan and actually start preparing some of the group, trying to get some analysis done on the oppositions in the group. I met them in Japan, and then you're just straight in. I think the following day we're getting ready to train, and then the following day you're presenting and you're saying, this is how I think we can beat Japan.
Yeah. That one worked out anyway. I remember I watched the game and you just stopped them getting the ball to the edge, and that was it. You just destroyed them. Then you put 40 on them, did you?
I think a lot of it, actually, that game was probably... it gave us a bit of an advantage because you got to feel the conditions. It was so hot and humid. It wasn't like a wet ball like we would associate playing in Galway or whether like whether it's hard to handle. The ball became like a bar of soap. It was just so, and discovering that in that game, we felt, okay, listen, teams are probably going to make the mistake. And if you look at a lot of the teams that tried to play too much rugby in those early pool games, how many times were people saying afterwards, there's so many handling errors, there's a pressure. It was just the ball was so slippery.
So it actually fed into your game plan. That's something I didn't realise. The fact that you were probably stronger on the side of not having the ball and just putting the opposition...
Being a little bit more pragmatic with it, yeah, kind of fed into it for sure, I think, yeah.
From the outside looking in at the end, obviously... it became a little bit more cemented how South Africa were playing for something more than just rugby, which other teams, you know, probably were. Playing for the nation, playing for the spirit of the nation in a country that's been divided and has gone through tough times. Was that something you could kind of see the second you came in the door?
No, I couldn't really understand. Like, it was, I don't think, and even now I still don't think I really fully understand it. It wasn't, when we got to South Africa then, you could actually see it was insane. There was just millions of people. So we did about 4 or 5 days of going around, but everywhere you went, it was just millions. Every airport, every time you were on the bus, people just waiting outside the hotels. It was crazy. It was insane. So I you couldn't really understand it. I found it really hard to grasp it. As the weeks went by, you're kind of going, okay, trying to get a handle on it.
Is that something they speak about in the dressing room before games?
No, I don't think it was ever used as this big, heavy, motivational tool. But certainly towards the end, as things were developing, you could just kind of see the lads were able to draw on it a bit more. And there's some pretty big leaders in that team, like Asiya, his story, a Pimpy story, and then just guys that, like a lot of the players, probably people don't know, but like they leave their clubs to come back to play for South Africa, and sometimes that could have a financial implication for them, but they want to play for South Africa so much that they'll do that. So yeah, they've there's definitely something there, or at least there was for the World Cup, that they absolutely used it.
Khaleesi and Mpimpi, they'd have been vocal, they'd have been speaking about the significance of it all, would they?
No, I don't think they'd ever be. Definitely two different characters. Like if we consider Paulie as one of the best captains, and we've all dealt with him, you know, he's not the same mold as that kind of person. It's not they're much more softly spoken. I mean, even in the post match interview, you can see Sia after like what is, you know, probably, you know, such an incredible moment, how composed and how controlled he is. And so no, they're much softer spoken, softly spoken people, but. Just, it's hard not to think about, say, and see his story has been much more publicised now. It's hard not to, when you're dealing with this guy, to go, you know, to hear the things and know the things that he's been through to from there to where he is now. It's just, you'd have to be a robot not to be pretty inspired by it.
So, so when you came in, like what I'm, I'd like to get, because obviously the lens that you see through it would be similar. We would see it through probably a similar lens. That's why I want to. Mm. When you came in to meet that squad to start with, say for the Japan game, and your squad was finalised, then what was your initial feeling of the vibe within the room? Was it confidence? Was it like this is a really tight group, or is it there's quite a bit that, you know, they need to win to get tighter to grow? You know, like, you know, you can have a group and everyone's like, yeah, we're all in this together, but you actually have to go in, you have to deliver, and then that's what actually brings you together that bit more. And a team can start off here and after four games suddenly be here, you know. Yeah. And the fact that like you actually lost your first game. Yeah. That's why I want to, like, did you feel when you walked in and said, these guys are ready to win a World Cup, or these guys know they can, but they know that there's a lot they have to go through?
Because you could probably see that more clearly than the guys who were there.
Yeah.
Like, just fresh eyes, more objective.
The biggest thing that struck me going in around this kind of theme that we're going to talk about is probably, it was more just there was a complete trust and alignment in what it is that we are going to set out to do. So if Jacques stood up and said, listen, we're going to do this, or our wings or our centres or whoever, you're going to do this, then that was it. You trusted it and there was complete alignment. Or if Andre Pollard stood up and said, listen, this is how we're actually going to go at it for the weekend, then there was just complete trust and alignment again. And that was, so I knew immediately when you can feel that vibe in a team where there's very little ego involved and it's just, everyone is just going for the one thing, then you can feel that, you can sense it. I don't have an example that I can use, but it just you know how Rassi is around making sure everyone's energies are going into one specific point, and that was just absolutely evident. I mean, they've been together for whatever it was, you know, 12, 13 or 14 months before I was there, so
that's what I mean. And that this isn't a group that, like, you generally I think of 2003, the English team that went to that World Cup, they had a 4-year cycle pretty much to get to that World Cup, whereas Rassi kind of came in probably 18 months out. And there was, like, when I look at, say, when Ireland beat them well in the Aviva, I looked at that team there and I went, you know, there's a good few fellas here who aren't around. There's still a bulk, there's still the bulk of the team. But, like, I was kind of wondering as in what the... I just couldn't understand what kind of feeling that, like, what did Rassi do to bring them together? Like, was it a very simple game plan? Was it something like the lads are talking about, saying, listen, you're playing for South Africa, or is that inherent in them? I don't need to say to you what it is you're playing for. But just there's so many different people who've got you've got Mpimpi.
Yeah.
And his story is probably going to be vastly different to what Dwayne Vermeulen's story is going to be.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to wonder how you... Like, that's sort of when people talk, this is what I'm asking. I was like, when people talk about rugby uniting South Africa, is like bringing people who've got very different circumstances together to be proud of one thing together. You know, so you've got like a dude who grew up in a township who, you know, was begging for food. You've got a guy who's maybe from, you know, a reasonably wealthy background and is a really hard worker. And, you know, traditionally people from the townships would probably not see rugby as their game, because it probably seems to be played by primarily, you know, guys from wealthier backgrounds, or from even kids who get picked up and brought into private schools. So what was it that you felt that Rassi probably tied the group together with? What was the common thread?
Again, I know it seems
a way of getting out of it. It's alignment, and it's just a commitment to what the plan was. So obviously a commitment to winning. So how does that manifest itself? And then it's just a commitment to the process of the week. So what we do on the Monday, what we do on the Tuesday, what we do on the Wednesday or the Thursday, depending on the turnaround, and just committing to it. Because the turnarounds are so fast at the World Cup, and sometimes you don't know, when we were talking earlier, we don't know who you're playing against on certain weekends. So there's very little time to be to try to like pick too many holes in what you're doing. You have to just trust that the person who is driving that certain area, and each player would have a responsibility for a certain area. You just had to trust that person was the best person to do that and go with it. And I think when you have a squad of 31, and I really emphasise the 31, because you know, certain guys knew their roles in that squad. I'm going to be playing against Canada. I'm going to be playing against Namibia. I might get the sub one or two other ones, but I have to make sure that we are fully prepared for that game, while other guys had to prepare for New Zealand and Italy, and then whatever happened after that happened. So it was just getting everyone to go for one thing, which was to win. But before that, the process is to win. But yeah,
And they weren't told unofficially that they were going to be playing in those kind of...
I'm not sure, Jimmy. Yeah, but
they would have had a fair idea. It would just be like an intrusion.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'd say some guys would be...
pay grade.
Exactly, yeah.
So what was your role on, let's say, going into the English match, and probably the one that stands out most, obviously, in everyone's mind, is your best performance and when everything just seemed to go right? What was your role that week building up to that game?
It would have been the same as it was for all the previous games, just to prepare the team in the areas that you feel there's space, or that you feel we can get a return on. So I think a lot of people thought that England game, everyone said, oh, geez, South Africa flipped their game plan for that game. It wasn't the case. It was just that was the bounce back from the Wales game, which was obviously a tough game of rugby to watch, because there was so much, there's so many moments of pressure swinging, that of potential, where there was a lot of kicking, there was a lot of just not cracking first kind of mentality. But people were critical of that, I think. But Wales had just won a Grand Slam, and although they'd lost one or two of their warm-up games, they'd still won all their games in the pool. And we felt, unfortunately, we knew the game was going to kind of go that direction. And then actually in the final, I felt the players just played unbelievably well. When you're 9 and you're 10 and you're 15, and that's just a name check, you're 2, when you're spine of your team, you're 8, all have crackers, and then obviously everyone else also played probably their best game of the World Cup, and then your bench also coming on, and you look at like Malcolm Marks coming on and having two massive involvements for the two tries. When your team just plays that well, there was no great change in your game plan. To put it in perspective, on a 6-day turnaround for the final, you do your Monday, which is generally whatever department, let's say it's your kicking game, but then you have one other training day. You have an hour on that one training day, so half of that goes to units. So now you have 15 minutes to train your attack and your defence. You can't change much in the week of a final on a 6-day turnaround. You have 15 minutes to train attack, 15 minutes to train defence. So everyone say, oh, they flipped the game. There was nothing like that.
So actually, ye controlling the narrative that goes on in the players' minds is actually the biggest thing, which is, so if I go back to the first game, when you lost to New Zealand, how did ye, like you're saying, short turnarounds, so you, like, what really impressed me about Rassie through the tournament is that he was able to sort of, he would control the narrative around where you were and how you were doing. So, but what was that internally consistent with what he was projecting externally? Like after he lost to New Zealand, like suddenly people start going, I understand what you're saying. It's very short periods. Everyone has to be 100% committed. And I think, to be fair, to any of the South African players I've ever worked with, they've been so coachable to take information on board. They're not second guessing, because you don't have the time to have these big, long debates, or, you know, you need to get to the point. And when you're winning, that's fine. Yeah. But when you lose, suddenly you get like this thing where you've got like 31 players looking at you wide-eyed going, our plan didn't work there. Now that's so how do you bounce back from that?
So we would have reviewed that game and we would have said we actually felt we were dominant for large parts of that game, and they scored their two tries from it happened to be kick reception. I think one was a kick reception and one might have been a turnover, and it had happened like bang bang. It was like 6 minutes where, kind of like what you were saying earlier with Racing, sometimes you can just go,
we didn't really do too much wrong there, but all of a sudden we're under our posts, and then you kick off the ball again, and within 30 seconds again, you're kind of almost under the pump, and then you're under your posts again, and you're going, what the hell's happened here? And we just conceded 14 points. So in review of that game, I mean, there was obviously huge moments where Chesnin very nearly went over on the far side. I think we got turned over twice just on their line. So there was loads of momentum swinging moments. And we said, well, look, if New Zealand are favourites for the World Cup, although many people said maybe England, but if New Zealand were one of the favourites for the World Cup, and that was it, and it was that close, and if we, let's say we take one of them, or we negate one of the turnovers, then we're right in the mix. And after that, it just got tighter and tighter and tighter. It was mad. It was a complete positive after it.
So that's so what you said, Baz, like, for them to actually click in the final, when I didn't think that the guys who actually make your attack game, I didn't feel that like Pollard or Leroux had hit anything like the form that they could do during the tournament. And for them to just go, it's not like he spent, like you just said, you've got 50 minutes to try and attack. So it's not like you're able to spend an awful lot more time in your attack and suddenly it's firing. It's actually whatever, they're obviously mentally, you know, very strong or whatever way you teed up the situation, said you just got to show up on today and play and bring yourselves to it, or what was it that got, because Pollard and Leroux, like they were not, like they didn't play like they could during the tournament.
I think with those two guys in particular, Leroux gets unless you have all the angles, you know when you're doing your analysis when you're playing and you had those behind angles, you got a wide shot and you have that and you don't always see the... I mean, Mpimpi has scored, I don't know how many tries he scored in the last, I think it's 14 or 15 out of 14 or 14 out of 15, something like that. And I swear, Willie Leroux has probably been the third last pass in 13 or 12 of those tries. So there's a huge amount of stuff that he does that I don't think a lot of people see. He also has high profile errors because he is that guy. He is the link guy. He is the one that that pressure comes on. So I think when people see that, they can be critical, but for sure, he is one of the best players for
if the pass sticks, it's a try. If it's not, he looks like...
But
I was just so impressed. I thought Pollard was just immense in the final, and I thought Leroux was immense, and I thought that was a lot of the difference. I remember speaking to Baz about it, and Baz just said, man, they looked like they attacked completely differently, and I said, I was like, it did, but like you're saying, that listen, it's not that we attacked completely differently. It's just that those lads fired, the bounce of the ball went our way, and the fact that they were mentally tough enough to bring themselves to that final. I wanted G to win. Obviously, they were playing England as well. I thought England were very good, but traditionally Irish people want, I don't know about you, but traditionally Irish people want to see anyone but England win.
Yeah.
And I remember watching the press conferences and the build-up, and I said, am I going to spend the next 20 years of my life watching all of these guys talk about... And that time, I remember, you know, talking about it, like, and dining out in it, like, and... But I couldn't see... You were incredibly good at certain aspects of the game, but I couldn't see how you could go from a... You know, when those key drivers of your attack game were operating, you know, subpar to what their level is. And then for them to suddenly go and just play so well.
Yeah, yeah. No. I would disagree to say that Andre wasn't at that level. I just think the games leading up to it were, again, we knew how the Wales game would go. We knew that game was going to lead into that kind of thing. And if you actually think about the game-breaking moments, it was all down to Andre. He was the guy who created those two or three sparks for us to get that try. And then
maybe you didn't see that because you've been out of coaching for a while.
You certainly didn't see it.
Not a clue.
And then the Japan game was the quarterfinal was... It was insane, first of all, because of the build up, and we were in Japan, and the emotion, and that was, I mean, every single person in the world wanted Japan to win that game, except unless you were South African, every other nation wanted Japan to win that game. So, and Japan hold the ball unbelievably well. So there was quite a specific way of going into that game, which I thought Andrew actually delivered pretty well. So I disagree with you.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, yeah. Fair enough.
So you name a lot of players there, and you do.
Who is that white guy? That skinny white guy that was in with us there. He's in with us. Like, what was he? Did he get a medal?
He's walking into teammates like, "Hey, buddy, who's this guy?"
But like, you're working closely with those guys over the last couple of months. When you played, I think you pride yourself on how hard you worked and how hard you trained. Probably the hardest trainer I've ever
and one of the best at breaking his neck.
Yeah,
very good at breaking his neck. Did that twice.
Reckless. What do you? How do you kind of look at those players that you coached over the last couple of months with that lens? Like how hard they work. Obviously, we saw the photo of them before the competition going in, and how insanely massive they all look. Mm. And I think Alad Walters is one guy that hasn't gotten too much of a mention. He's in your shadow massively, actually. But just over here in the media, but we all know how I think amazing balance, a guy he is.
For balance, there. If they'd put Felix in that picture with the rest of them, I think that would have... Yeah, well, some of them are big, but some of them are actually...
Alan's on billboards over there, man.
Is he?
He was on a billboard earlier this year.
Really?
Yeah.
He's obviously done an incredible job with the players. Yeah. They must love him.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they absolutely love him. I mean, Alan's got such a good way about him. It's very hard not to want to work hard for him. He brings such an element of crack, but still manages to get what's needed done. So, like, I think we spoke about this before as well. I think the S&C guy is the person who probably has the most contact time with the player. So how he rocks up in the morning, or how he rocks up to a gym session or a pitch session warm up, can often determine the vibe of the next hour or two. And Al has got a really good feel for the pulse on that. And then on top of that, he's also probably, I feel, leading the way across the world. He's the best S&C coach I've seen from the point of view of being able to integrate the rugby into the stuff he's doing. So, I mean, he'll sit the entire time of a coach's meeting and look at all the previews and all the departments of the game, and then he'll taper his warm-ups, or how he themes things even in the gym, or as the primers before speed and stuff. He'll taper all that stuff to just so that it's all kind of just feeding through, and it's across the program for the week. He'll have it all lined up, and that's where I feel he's just above the rest.
You must have had a kind of a moment between the two of you. We were like, what the fuck? How did this happen?
Alad actually, he had his parents over there, and they actually went down onto the pitch and stuff, so it was a great moment for his dad was still wearing a Scarlet's jacket. His dad is a massive Scarlet supporter. Never goes to a game without it, so it was funny. Yeah,
that's hilarious, man. And so the celebrations insane over in South Africa.
Like, yeah, it was crazy. Yeah.
Who's leading the charge?
People. Different days. A lot of guys were leading. Bongi was unbelievable. He just couldn't. He just had so much energy. Yeah, he just constantly up for it the whole time. And C as well. You know, for a guy whose life now has probably just changed completely, he was just able to just go again and go again and just keep giving energy back to the crowd. But it was hard not to, because and it's hard to comprehend it, but it was just, there's so many people everywhere we went. So we'd be on a bus for maybe 5-6 hours, or even some days it was like longer, it was 8 or 9 hours. It's just constant masses of people, just masses.
Hitting up every different city.
Yeah,
every
so we were in Durban, Johannesburg, Cape Town, Port Elizabeth. We went to Zweden as well, Soweto, places, just crazy places to go to, yeah. And what you were saying earlier was the rugby in the townships, I think, you'd hope that you'll get a massive bounce back from this. I think Supersport made it free to air for the first time. So, yeah. You know, there's probably an extra couple of million people now watching that and seeing seeing a captain and lifting the cup. Hopefully it'll have a bounce back.
It'd be interesting to see how they capitalize on the positive wave. Like, if it's, you know, people say like it's so great for the country. I said, well, what's practically going to change for some guy now, you know, who's in a township or I suppose, look, Rassi's obviously super empowered, and I know that he was trying to tap into that anyway all the time when he was involved in the high performance area with South African Rugby Union. But you know, do you understand what I'm trying to get a pathway so that those kids that see it go, I can actually get into that pathway as well.
Yeah, and that's Rassi's going to be. You know how passionate he is about making sure South Africa is a sustainable force in rugby. So I'm sure he's been busy implementing all that stuff and putting it in.
The Lions series couldn't come at a better time for them now that they've won the World Cup and the focus is kind of back on them. That's the next big international competition, 2 years' time, and they get to defend that title against, you know, the Lions, who obviously will bring a huge amount of attention. Is that something that you kind of want to be around for? Or?
I don't know, Baz, to be honest with you. I'm not sure what my story is going to be. I kind of promised Leanne that I wouldn't engage too much in what's next. I said, well, let's get to Christmas and then we'll have a few discussions. So I don't know. Obviously, geez, being involved in something like that would be incredible.
But there's a few. I don't know if there's is there a few options at the minute, or is it something like,
you know, everyone wants him? I think at this point, like he's an original member of Hermitage Green.
You were trying to get me back into the game yesterday.
Right away, got a World Cup winner. That's really Dermy. Sorry, man, you're gone.
Yeah. I was going to ask what will happen with Dermy if I do come down and play. Will we just both be sitting beside each other,
embarrassing, playing Balrog? Well, Dermy's kind of expanded into electronic drums now.
Right.
You said I was going to get a gig as well.
So that's you.
We've
got two drummers already. Now we have four.
What was the name of your band again?
I can't remember.
You wouldn't tell me. What was the name of it?
For the life, I just can't remember.
Really?
What they're
you
called?
You can't remember.
I'll tell you later on.
Ah, you're lying. So there's evidence of this out there somewhere.
I don't know. Of what?
Of your band.
I don't know. There might be some footage.
I'll get on to Anna. I'll find out.
Anna hasn't actually.
I think the Balrog was like the most perfect instrument for Felix to play. Just give him something that he can just, because he can't sit still anyway. He's always like tapping something or hitting something. It's like, just give him that and let it make noise.
Didn't you play the Balrog with Christy Moore that time in camp?
Didn't you?
And then you were like, everybody was rummaging around and someone handed you something and you're like, this isn't the correct stick.
A spoon.
It was like,
I think it was more like, you know, Dermy has like kind of almost, they're almost like a load of little sticks as a stick with rubber bands on it. That was kind of.
Oh, hot rods.
Yeah, kind of like hot rods, yeah.
What are your thoughts? I've never even asked you this. What are your memories of being in the band and that time when we were both injured and we were, I suppose, it should be in a depressing place in Munster, not able to play, two long-term serious injuries, and then all of a sudden we're playing four or five gigs a week.
The best parts about it, it wasn't really the gigging. I know you, probably a little bit different to you guys. Like the music for me, I'm not really into music. I'm not good at music. It was just the crack. That's actually what I was missing. It was almost like, because when you're injured, you know the way sometimes you're injured in a rugby group and then your schedule completely changes.
Yeah.
And you're not. And you almost start hanging around with the injured guys and you have your own little pod of things, and you kind of miss that a little bit when you have a long term injury. So I've just felt that the music was such an escape of us just having the crack, where we'd go and rehearse, but like most of the time you're just fucking about and having the crack and talking about what happened on the weekend or what happened at anything really. I missed the fun of it. I don't really miss the music. Your ears would be ringing so badly after the gigs and stuff, and I'd be trying to sleep. I'm like, I've got to get up and do rehab in the morning. I was just like, this is no longer sustainable for me.
Yeah.
But it was some crack.
We had a great time. Well, we'll get you back over Christmas. I think you've committed now at this stage.
Yeah, we'll do something.
We're going to sell out on the back of Felix Jones' World Cup medal. He'll bring it, I promise. The two of you had some interesting times together as well.
We did, yeah. Whenever you were talking about how hard a trainer he is, it reminded me of our trip to Pará. When we went to Pará. You know, seen that? The gap, yeah, in Peru.
Camp Pará?
Yeah, it's like a piss take of kind of posh English people going to the gap, yeah, to raise awareness.
You know, seen that, yeah.
Anyway,
raises awareness,
yeah, exactly, we did, yeah, for all the wrong reasons. But we've talked about that story, we've talked that to death, but whenever you're talking about how hard a trainer he is and how competitive he is and how fired up he is,
there was a fellow who was looking after us, David Cassidy, we were talking about him earlier on. He owns the hostel in Peru, and they looked after us very well.
Lucky hostels, yeah.
Lucky hostels, yeah. You'll get a warm welcome there. You'll get looked after. But this guy prides himself on being he has the record walking home from some bar in town up to the hostel. It's like, what was it, 10-minute walk?
Yeah, but it's altitude. It's high up, yeah.
But it's a fast, it's not a normal 10-minute walk. It's probably a half-hour walk. But this guy is like a competitive walker. And this is his thing. This is his pride and joy that he has the record walking home from the bar. Felix beat him.
Felix beat him home.
Walking. I don't think, if I could have walked fast enough to beat him, I don't think I would have had the heart, because it meant so much to him.
Felix made me feel so bad.
Yeah, he was ruthless.
He's one thing he had.
Because he was so good to us. Yeah, he's still in contact with us, but he looked after us so well.
Yeah.
I mean, he actually took us out for a meal that night, and then I remember when we shot off, we were so shocked at the speed, we were both laughing for so long. Yeah. But then we got there, I was like, no, we got to the front door, and then we got in, and he was so disappointed, and you were like, I can't believe he did that. You're heartless. So good to us. He's like, what are you doing? And I was like,
let him win his race. Like, what does it mean to us?
Anyway, so you were walking back together and he bolted and he said,
I was planning.
He was like, go.
It was
and he took off.
He wanted to race us.
And what, like, you couldn't, like, bend at the knee. It was like keeping the legs.
Is that weird hip thing? Like,
yeah.
I cheated a bit and still didn't get anywhere near these two.
Amazing.
Two freaks.
Yeah. So that was our gap year.
Yeah.
In Peru.
Yeah.
Good trip. I haven't heard from much from you since.
After you didn't name your child Felix, I thought it was...
Yeah,
Felix,
everyone else did. It's like most children in Munster.
He was going to, but then he chickened out.
O'Connell, Niall Ronan, John Ryan, is it?
Trimby was going to, but he chickened out.
Yeah. Yeah, Felix and Alfie were both in the mix.
You're joking. Three Munster players.
And I went for Jack. Sorry. If I have any more, I think if Anna gets her way, we will have more. I don't want to have any more, but worst case scenario, I'll get the call. Number 4, Felix, if I'm lucky enough to have
one. I don't know how to do that now.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's just a cat. It's more of a cat's name.
That was actually Anna's issue with it. She overruled me.
Okay, I think we've held you up for long enough. I'm sure you're...
You've probably got some more World Cups to win or something.
Yeah.
I thought we were going for lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Do we have to pay for to go for lunch now? I presume, like... It's all paid dinners and lunches.
I went for dinner with him last Monday, man, and he brought his medal with him, like, as in, like, and brought it in and showed it to the people in the restaurant straight away. I was like, oh my God, this is so arrogant. And I was like, I still end up paying for the meal. Yeah. But I was like, Felix, like, oh, just so you, in case you missed this, I have my medal with me.
All right. Well, you'll stick around for Black and White. This is our ridiculous game that we play at the end. So we'll take a quick break and we'll come back with Black and White.
You're listening to Baz and Andrew's House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness.
Okay, time for Black and White. We're going to mix it up a little bit because we've got Felix here. We've got a World Cup winning coach. We're going to get him to judge. What we're going to have is we're going to have over the first 6 Pro 14 games and the last two European rounds, we're going to get Barry and Andrew are both going to pick their team of foreign players, Irish qualified foreign players. And we'll get Jonesy to judge which team he thinks would win.
But also some young players who were at the World Cup. Because they have to have the opportunity to feature.
If they're in your form 15 over the course of the last 6 Pro 14 games and 2 European games.
You didn't answer my question though, but if the guys are at the World Cup, does that mean they're not allowed
to
play?
No, well, if they've come in and they've played really well, but they have to have played.
Fine.
Okay, fine. Fine.
Fine, I don't care.
Okay. Baz, I think you're a little bit more prepared, so we'll go with you.
I'll go first.
Okay.
Okay, at number one, Lewis Head, Lochman, Kelleher at hooker, Marty Moore at tight head, Alton Delam, based on his performance the weekend for Connacht, in the second row, James Ryan, Scott Penny. Now, I know he hasn't played that much, but I think he's a big fan of the show, and we're a big fan of him.
Okay.
And he shows enough potential and try scoring pedigree. To keep him
get on with us.
To keep him in my team. I'm going to go for Nick Timoney at 7. going to go for let me just
Eric Miller.
Max Deegan at 8, Cooney at 9. I've gone for Sprout at 10. Ooh. Fair play to him, away from home. James Lowe on the left. Scannell, honourable mention for Farrell at 12. Ringrose at 13. Ringrose on fire at the minute. Robbie Little on the right, and Conway at 15, because Robbie Little's on the right. Purely because.
Conway's at 15.
Yeah, only because he would be on the right. But I need Robbie Little in there.
Okay.
Politics.
Baz.
I've gone with a pretty similar, exact same front five. Lachman, Kelleher, Moore, Delan, Ryan.
You didn't go Delan. You wrote Delan down there when I said Delan.
No, it's
Felix.
There.
Thank you.
Hello, Felix. Who do you think you are?
He's the judge. Reese Ruddock, Van der Fleer, Deegan. I've gone with Cooney at 9. I've gone with Scannell at 10. Because I think he's been playing like a 10 for the last few weeks, and I think he's been exceptional. I think he could make a brilliant 10. I've stuck Earlsey on the wing because he's just finishing for fun over the last few weeks. Put McCluskey in 12. I've always been a big fan of his. Didn't play particularly well at the weekend, but I like his style. Ringrose's been exceptional. I've gone with Conway in the wing and Will Addison, the love of my life, at fullback.
Oh, Will. Have you ever met Will?
So
I haven't.
Great.
It kind of boils down. So the packs are pretty similar. It's Scannell versus
Sprout
versus
who's
Sprout.
Your goal kicker? Is it Scannell?
Yep. No, Cooney.
Yes.
We're gonna have to take your first answer.
And you went with Conway on the wing and Addison at 15.
Yeah.
So Mike Haley doesn't make either of your 15s.
He's exceptional the weekend. Best game for Munster yet. But I just love Will Addison.
Okay. Jonesy? Judge?
I'm going to go with Trimby.
Yeah?
Scannell let me down.
Based on?
No, I don't think he let you down. He's been playing unbelievable. He definitely deserves to be in one of the teams. But I think Sprout deserves an honourable mention.
Yeah. We're all very proud. What is it, Sprite's real name again?
Connor Fitzgerald.
Can we get him on the show?
I think he's probably too Billy Big Time for us now, but we can always try, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
He's a great story, and he's like his older brother Stephen, that's the turnip head. Like two really quality athletes, and Stephen was outstanding for the Irish 20s and came into Munster and showed flashes of magic. Mm. He was just consistently putting it together. Like, just he has like real high points, but then he'd have a couple of errors, which happens, but like, you know, really like has an ability to go all the way.
They're both so determined. They're just, when you're talking, you know they're going to make it eventually.
But how determined are they? Would they beat David Cassidy back to the hostel in a walking race?
That's why Felix likes.
That's all race to lunch, right? That's the next order.
Okay, well, hang on. I'm gonna give.
He hasn't won one in a month.
It's a bit of a sympathy one, but I'll take it.
There you go, Trimby.
I'm back.
Based on our guest judge, Felix Jones.
Yeah, thanks, Felix.
Well, Felix, thanks a million for coming on, man. It's been a pleasure. Congratulations again. What an incredible achievement, Trimby Flat. Thanks very much. And we'll see you next week. Thank you to everybody for listening, and for any of you watching on YouTube, hello. Thanks to everyone involved in producing today's show. Producer Pat, to Dermot, to Ian, to Paul, and to Anthony. We'll see you next week. This has been Baz and Andrews, House of Rugby, here on Joe, together with Guinness. Party on.
Party on.
You were listening to Baz and Andrews, House of Rugby on Joe, together with Guinness. Drink responsibly. Visit drinkaware.ie for the facts.